Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Texas public school finance system, we know that the system in place is now it's unfair and it's unconstitutional. And we know that because a judge told us. You can also ask the over 600 school districts across the state that brought the lawsuit against the current system and against the state of Texas. But how long has this been going on? 30 years plus? And what's it going to take to fix it? And why is it taking so long? Is there a way to break away from the local property tax system and still avoid other issues that are in the Texas Constitution, like their prohibition on a statewide property tax? It's complex. It's overwhelming. We're going to try and break it down for you. And what do you want to see happen with the Texas school finance system? We invite you to join our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980-898. You could also email your questions and comments to the source at tpr.org. Joined by Albert Cortez, he's the Director of Policy at the Intercultural Development Research Association. Albert, welcome to the source.
Thank you.
So how long have you been messing with this school finance stuff?
I date back to 1977 when I started working on the issue at IDRA and testified in several of the court cases, worked with the legislature over upteen sessions trying to get this thing right, and we're still working on it.
What's the big holdup? Why is it so complicated to fix? Don't other states have school finance systems that seem to work?
There are states that do a better job. The larger states have a tougher time with it because of the complexity of the issue, but it is fixable. What you need is will to do it. And you've got to be willing to make the investments that it takes to have a quality education for all kids.
So when we talk about will to do it, that's basically code for we need lawmakers that want to fix it.
We need lawmakers and leadership at the state level that's willing to make the reforms that are needed in terms of the system and then make the investments that are required. It don't come cheap.
It won't come cheap, that's for sure. And that's what people are, you know, homeowners are of two minds, I can imagine, being one. You want a system that works. You want they want children to be educated, but yet you get that property tax bill, and you're wondering where's it going to end?
You look at it as an investment. It is an important fact to bring forward that the state hasn't even attempted to come up with a cost of what it takes to provide an adequate education that will meet state standards.
That's like a cost per child.
Cost per student.
They have no idea what it would cost to educate a child in the Texas public school system. Why would they, you know, they say, I want the government to run like a business. And that's the first thing you figure out when you're a business is how much it's going to cost you to create one widget. So we should know how much it's going to cost to educate one child.
The Supreme Court recently raised that same question about why is it that the state hadn't gotten around to doing a cost study, even questioned why they hadn't directed the Legislative Budget Board that has the data and the capability to do that. The truth of it is the state of Texas for a long time hasn't wanted to know.
But aren't there laws that are required a state to figure these things out?
There were some laws that were written directing the state to try to come up with estimates. And conveniently, the state, because of lack of direction from the leadership, never got around to conducting the studies. Or if they were done, they were so poorly done that they weren't considered reliable.
All right. So how do we know that the system is unfair and unconstitutional, other than the fact that we had a big trial and a judge told us this? But what does it mean to say that?
Well, if you look at the amount of funding that's spent in different districts of different wealth around the state, we know that there's over $1,000 difference per student in the amount of money that's spent in the poorest districts in the wealthiest districts versus the poorest districts.
So there's a big disparity between some school districts.
There's disparities in revenues per student. There's also disparities in tax rates. So if you live in some of the lower wealth districts in the state, you actually wind up paying higher taxes on your property than you live in the wealthier districts.
But what about this observation that this $1.50 cap on local school district taxes is a de facto statewide property tax. What's the problem with that?
Well, first of all, the $1.50 tax includes, you know, facilities funding. So, you know, normally when we talk about the tax cap issue, we refer to a $1.17 number, which is the maintenance and operations limit. 200 districts are already at the max around the state. The majority of them are low-wealth and mid-wealth districts. But you've got a number of districts that haven't maxed out the system. But there's a reason for that. In order for them to get above a particular level, they've got to have a tax ratification election, get the local voters to agree to raise their own property taxes. When these local voters know that there's a fundamental problem with the system that they'd like to see fixed.
Right, so that's the challenge to deal with it on the local level, is that some schools, look, let's talk about like Edgewood. We'll use Edgewood because the Edgewood versus Kirby was the fundamental lawsuit that first brought this forth, right?
That's correct.
And so, and it was held up as a poor property, poor school district. And because you couldn't raise property taxes to a level in that school district that would, because of these laws that prohibited you raising it to that level, to raise enough money to actually educate children at a level that could compete with other school districts.
That's right. And Edgewood, using that example, is one district that has maxed out that tax effort at $1.17. They are at max. So even if they wanted to raise their taxes above that to provide additional revenue that they need to provide the quality of education they want for their kids, they're prohibited from doing it because of state law.
And so what's it like to be in a kid? I think, you know, as we go back and forth and we go, oh, let's have another year of, you know, beating our gums about what to do about school finance. I'm thinking there's another kid. You only get 1 year in seventh grade, hopefully, you know, if you do it right. But that's a year lost if that school isn't adequately providing that kid the right education.
Right. So if we go back 30 years and the number of children that we've lost over that period of time because of our unwillingness to do what's needed and raise the revenue that's needed. At the same time, as we talk about revenue, the state's sitting over $10 billion in the rainy day fund, and they're refusing to invest in improving public education. That's like eating bologna sandwiches while you have steaks in the freezer. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, the rainy day fund is there specifically for when you have a budget shortfall, and it's there to avoid some of the mistakes that the legislature has made in the past. You know, budgeting in a biennium type of process is an iffy kind of thing. Something I think we're going to experience again in the upcoming legislative session because how low oil is and how the state has budgeted for this biennium. But so we're going to keep talking about the school finance system, trying to unpack it in a way and explain it and lay it out so people can get a better idea, because this is our school system. It's our taxes. These are our kids. And we need to have a better idea of how things are progressing. We invite you into our conversation. If you've got a question, a comment, an observation, call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back in 1 minute. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The unending trial of the public school finance system in Texas. This is a system that pays for schools, and it's been declared unconstitutional and unfair. And the outcomes, they're inadequate. We can look at the recently released SAT scores to show that Texas continues to fall behind in comparison to the rest of the nation. But are we any closer to crafting a more fair system that will pay for public education? With me in the studio to talk about this is Albert Cortez. He's the director of policy at the Intercultural Development and Research Association. What is the Intercultural Development and Research Association?
IDRA is a research, training, and technical assistance group, a private nonprofit. It's been around since 1973. We not only work around school funding equity issues, but generally work with schools to try to help them become effective for all students.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. Tom is on the line. Tom, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I'll try to make it brief. My children grew up in a low-income neighborhood right across the fence from Kirby. One of my daughters got a presidential scholarship to Incarnate Word and got a master's out of A&M. She happens to teach English now in the Edgewood School District, and I can tell you in no uncertain terms the problem is not finances and economics. It is disruptive students, irresponsible parents, and teachers who cannot control these kids who disrupt education for others. And that is a trend that's been going on in this town for a long time, and it's getting worse.
Okay, Tom.
Finances or no finances.
Okay, Tom. Thanks for calling in. So Tom echoes an opinion that we've had brought up by the state during the arguments before the Texas Supreme Court that more money is not pixie dust. You can't sprinkle it on top of school districts and suddenly think it's going to solve all their problems.
We've heard that argument. It's an old argument that money doesn't make a difference. What seems to contradict it is every time we try to get the higher wealth districts to work with us on changing the system, make it more equitable, they don't want to give up any of their money. So obviously money does make a difference. The research all over the country has well established that for decades. You need to make that investment in order to get a return on investment. This thing about throwing it on the parents, I'm a graduate of the Edgewood Independent School District. I'm one of those exceptions that despite a lot of inequity in the system, I'm not worried about the 5% that managed to go to college from my generation. I'm worried about that other 95% that is still stuck in the system that is very unfair and unjust. The parents at Edgewood and in every other district send you the best children they've got. They depend on the schools to even the playing field, to give everybody an equal chance to be successful. To blame either the children or the parents when the state plays a major role in the problems that are created is too easy and out.
Well, but we do have a lot of stressed out families in these lower income school districts and neighborhoods, and not just in San Antonio, but everywhere in the country. And those stresses are displayed, you know, in the classroom frequently.
They are, and that's why school districts need to have the fact that they deal with different challenges around different students, whether it's a special education student, a visually impaired student, or a low-income student. They require certain kinds of strategies in order to maximize those students' potential. But those kinds of specialized strategies aren't going to be provided for free. They do take resources. We also have to recognize that it's a front-end investment. If we invest in quality education for our children, the return on that investment will be paid back manyfold when these students graduate from high school, go on to college, and get better-paying jobs.
But I think about the exceptional students, that there are kids that are in these poorer school districts. When I do some reporting, I meet some incredible kids in school districts that are just barely hanging on. And they have fewer opportunities. And I worry about them. Yeah, there are some kids that are, you know, disruptive, and maybe they've already, maybe, you know, it's going to be hard to salvage them. But there's some great, great, great kids out there. And you want the best for them because they still have that light in their eyes, and they want to, and you're wondering, is that opportunity, is that ladder still available to them? Because they don't have all the classes, they don't have the AP classes in that school, and it's challenging for them.
Interesting that you note that, because we work with thousands of school districts and thousands of students around the state and the country. We find that aspirational levels for students are tremendous. We talk to students over 90%. When you talk to them at the elementary level, they say they want to go to college, they intend to be professionals, get good jobs, etc. Somewhere along the line, as they get older and realize unfairness around society and the systems of education, you still find some diehards that go like, I'm going to find a way to be successful. But students from schools that are underfunded have a much steeper climb to make, a much tougher challenge to overcome those obstacles if the resources were provided, the resources that they need. And in testimony, superintendent after superintendent made the point they're willing to take on the challenge of educating each and every child that they get in their system, but they've got to get support from the state to get the job done.
So we've talked about numbers and what it costs. What the state should have a better idea what it would cost to educate one student. Do you have an idea what that number should be?
Trial, what came forth from expert witnesses, you know, the number was around between $65 and $6,800 per student. The state average is around $5,500 right now. So we know that it takes well over $1,000 plus beyond the current funding level to get students at the standard that the state established for our kids, and that is that they be college ready by the time they graduate.
So about $1,000 per student shortfall that we're looking at.
The judge actually used a round number of around $2,000 per student.
And so where would that money come from if that was going to be made up?
Well, that's where the state's got to take a step back and look at its revenue sources. You know, there is an over-reliance in Texas on the local property tax. You know, compared to other states, Texas relies primarily on the sales tax and local property taxes and then other taxes to supplement that. The third leg in many other states is the state income tax. In this state, we know that's kind of a third rod. A lot of leadership people stay away from it, but at some point...
I mean, it would basically be impossible to get a state income tax in Texas, even if suddenly, miraculously, we had a shift in the public will and they demanded a state income tax. There's so many backstops that have been built into the state constitution and the legal system to prevent that from happening that we'd have to figure something else out.
There are other options. You know, we had systems in place in the past where there was tax-based consolidation at the county level, where districts were clustered and districts of varying wealth were given the opportunity to actually share resources. The system was actually working. It was in place in the 1980s as one of the solutions to
people
to
call
the
it
system.
The Robin Hood plan.
Well,
that was not actually it, but they call it that.
That happened. Actually, the system I'm referring to was the county education district plan.
Okay.
Wealthy districts didn't like the idea of sharing resources. They went to court. Got that declared unconstitutional. That's when we wound up with recapture, which is a variation of the concept, which is districts with excess revenue use that excess revenue to help the state subsidize having a quality education for all kids.
But is that, I mean, it still seemed to me like they could make a really good argument why that's not legal, because you're having taxation without representation. You're taking money from one district and moving it to another district, or those taxpayers don't have a voice in how that money is being spent.
Actually, the state Supreme Court ruled the recapture system as being constitutional because districts have multiple options beyond recapture. They can go with voluntary consolidation, de-annexing some of their properties. So there are various options that are provided that made that option constitutional. But the notion of recapture came into play because the state was looking for another revenue source in order to help pay for the system.
So are you recommending that in order to find that $2,000 shortfall that we double down on that system and go back to it?
No, recapture was never the total answer to the problem. It was one way of keeping districts in the system that were wealthy and needed to have a vested interest in having a high-quality system. The fact that we have recapture doesn't provide as much money as needed. We need to broaden the revenue base. We need to expand where we get our revenue. There was, you know, a recent court case that talked about very unfair appraisal practices.
The appraisal property taxes, that commercial property taxes, real estate is not paying their fair share.
Right. The point there is that businesses tend to be not valued at full market value on the rolls compared to residential property, and therefore that creates a real disparity on how much homeowners wind up paying of right. the tax bill.
So if you have this entire sector of the economy not paying the full value because of the secrecy of what the actual property value is, they're not paying their fair share in, as a property tax, and maybe there's this whole other source that can be tapped in to make the, shore up the shortfall.
That, you know, that's one of those sources that is an underutilized revenue source.
Okay, and when are we going to find out what's going to happen with the Supreme Court?
Not being a betting person, I suspect that we may not get a ruling until sometime early spring. Keep in mind that there were thousands of exhibits, hundreds of hours of testimony during the last case. It's going to take a while for the Supreme Court to go through all of that, but we expect that they'll be able to come up with a ruling by early next year.
And we'll look forward to what happens next after that. Albert Cortez, Director of Policy at the Intercultural Development Research Association. This is The Source on KSTX.